And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Political anthropologists are busy analyzing the Trump communities and how Democrats can make inroads there. Well, Sherry Bustos thinks she knows the answer because she won by 20 points in her race for Congress in 2016 in a rural Illinois district that Donald Trump carried by 3 points. I sat down with her last week to talk about that, the state of the Democratic Party, and what she thinks may happen in 2018. Sherry Bustos, so good to see you on a cold winter day here in Chicago.
It is cold.
Thank you for
see you, David.
Crossing
you.
The frozen tundra of Illinois to be here this morning. You know, when I sit down with people, they all have different pathways to whatever they're doing. Usually it's politics, some, not always. But yours was pretty clear in that you were surrounded by politics and journalism all your life.
I was.
Tell me about that.
So we can go back to, I was a three-year-old girl, a little girl, living in a place called Garden Courts, which is, I think it's public housing now, on the east side of Springfield. And my grandfather was elected to the state legislature.
So he was a farmer?
He was a hog farmer.
Yeah,
he was a hog farmer. I come from a long line of farmers. We have, my grandpa was a hog farmer. My aunt and uncle are still dairy farmers. We have cousins who are Angus farmers. They all grow corn and beans. So long, long line of farmers. But so he was elected to the state legislature. And
why did he run?
This was, you remember the bedsheet ballot?
Yes, yes. In Illinois, back in 64.
Yeah, it was 1964.
Not to date you.
Well, I was 3 years old in 1964.
All right.
Yeah.
That's it. Already news streaming out of here. But the, for quirky reasons, every state legislator was on one big ballot in the state.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. I know you know this history better than I do. But so he had been the party chair in Iroquois County. So Iroquois County lived in a little farm town called Milford, which is where my dad and his brother and two sisters were all born and lived until my dad went away to college. But so he ran, was only the second Democrat ever to be elected from Iroquois County for any race.
And was this because his name was well known in the county? Or I'll tell you, because what I remember about the bedsheet ballot is the two top finishers were, I think, Earl Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson III.
Yeah, and my grandfather's name was Joseph Callahan. So he had a pretty good Irish name.
Irish names do well.
A good ballot name. And then, of course, 2 years later, being in this very, very Republican area, he didn't win. So he was in for one term. But I bring that up because, and these are still memories I have, but my grandma and grandpa would come down to Springfield, which is where I grew up, and stay at our house when they were in session. And so I just liked it because my grandma and grandpa stayed with us. And so that would have been like my earliest memories of being around anything political. But at that same time, my father was a political reporter for back in the day, the State Journal Register in Springfield was, they had a morning paper and a PM. And my dad worked at the Register and he had a political column called Calligrams.
I should point out your dad was a legend in Illinois politics. He was around Illinois politics for a half a century.
Yeah, a long time.
And but I only say that to say I was very, very familiar with him.
Yeah.
And everybody in politics here was.
Well, you go back to the Paul Simon days with him.
I do.
Yeah.
He, well, talk about that. I mean,
sure.
Your dad, because he made a transition that I made from journalism to politics. You still were a little girl when that happened.
Yeah.
Why did he make that transition?
Well, so he had been he graduated from Illinois College in Jacksonville in 1955, went to the Army, served for 2 years in the Army, most of that time in Germany, came back, married my mom in 1957, started having kids in 58, 59, and 61. And so he had three little kids. And again, I was telling you, we lived in this a duplex in Garden Courts. People in Springfield would know where that is. And we outgrew this little place. And he wasn't making very good money. So he goes to the editor at the time and asked for a raise. And the editor said, well, Gene, you're already the best paid reporter we have. We can't give you any more. So at the same time, do you remember anything about this meat scandal that the state of Illinois had?
Vaguely, yeah.
All right. So there was a meat scandal, and what it was is horse meat was being sold as beef. And so the governor's office, it would have been Governor Kerner at the time, decided that they needed somebody to help get this thing out of the press and you know, so they could move on and get the work done. So they offered my dad a job. It was significantly more pay. So the only reason he left journalism, because he loved it, loved every minute of it, was because he couldn't make any more money there. He had, you know, three kids and a wife who was staying at home with us. And he had this job offer and took it. And so he was handling press. He was a deputy press secretary in the Kerner administration.
Assigned to the horse meat scandal.
the horse meat scandal. And basically just, you know, I never asked him about how he got it straightened up, but I'm guessing they just took accountability and said, look, we're going to have better oversight and make sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
So that's why he left journalism after, you know, a decade or so and went into politics.
And he ended up next working for Paul Simon, a guy who I left journalism to work for. Paul was the lieutenant governor of Illinois at the time. Talk about that relationship, because a lot of folks who are listening don't know who. They probably think Paul Simon is the guy who teamed up with Art Garfunkel and made a lot of really
different Simon from
good records.
Yeah. Well, you know, I consider Paul Simon one of the best public servants our state has ever produced.
Yeah.
He was at the time lieutenant governor, and my dad went from Kerner. Then, if you remember, for a short time, there was Governor Shapiro.
Yes.
And worked with Governor Shapiro and then to Paul Simon. So that was that's where he how he ended up with Paul Simon. Paul Simon was lieutenant governor. My dad was his, I think they called it administrative assistant at the time, but would be chief of staff now. And Paul made a decision to run for governor, which is, I think, probably at about the time where you and my father started.
I was a little bit later. Yeah.
Okay,
but 1972, Paul Simon ran for governor,
and that was the first person I ever went door to door for. So I would have been about 10 years old at the time, but Paul Simon was this guy who always wore a bow tie.
Yeah.
Had this real deep baritone voice,
thick big horn rim glasses.
Yeah, big horn rim glasses. I mean, there you wouldn't
he
have
looked like Orville Redenbacher.
Paul,
I don't know if when I worked for Paul, his suits were always several inches too short in the pants.
Yeah.
And it turned out that some constituent had died in Southern Illinois and bequested his
that sounds
suits
like
to Paul.
Paul.
And Paul said, well, why get them, you know, why bother getting them fixed? You know, they serve their purpose.
Yeah, that sounds like
Paul. You know, the thing about Paul was, and, you know, when I left journalism, I loved journalism as your dad loved it. And we're going to talk about your career in journalism,
sure.
But I felt if I was going to leave, I should leave for someone in whom I believed and mm-hmm. who I knew would never embarrass me other than the short pants. and Paul was a guy who had started a little newspaper himself or bought one in Southern Illinois, used it to crusade against corruption down there, ran for office for that reason because nobody else would, got elected in his mid-20s, and went to the legislature and fought for political reform and fought for civil rights, which wasn't easy in Southern Illinois. He was an exemplary public servant, really was.
He was for his entire career. So, he would go on not to win that race for governor.
Yes,
it was
not to win because he supported an income tax.
Because he was honest with the voters, and it was it was something that was needed.
Right.
And but his candor led to his defeat. And my dad would always say too that in this Democratic primary, it was against Dan Walker. That Dan Walker would criticize Paul, and Paul didn't want to hit back, and so he ends up losing. And I still remember
Dan Walker ended up in the penitentiary, and Paul ended up in the U.S. Senate, so it all worked out.
I remember waking up that next morning. We would always stay up really late on election night and thinking, oh, my gosh, my dad's out of a job. What are we going to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was, like, really worried about this.
Yeah.
And then he would go on to – he had a short stint in city government working for one of the city commissioners for less than a year, and then went to work with Alan Dixon, who at the time was state treasurer, then became secretary of state, and then U.S. Senator.
U.S. Senator.
Yeah.
And what did being around all of this do for you? What did you take in from being surrounded by all of this?
Well, so probably one other thing to mention about Paul Simon, and I hope your listeners can get a feel for just what a tremendous guy this was. But after he lost, he got a job out at Harvard to teach. So he took his wife Jean, who he had served in the state legislature with and had married her. And they had two kids at the time, Martin and Sheila. Sheila, who would go on to be our lieutenant governor in our state. But at the time, they were little. And they move out to Massachusetts. And Paul teaches, and the kids enroll in school. He decides after one semester, he wants to come back to Illinois. Well, but he doesn't want to take his kids out of school. So Paul ends up living with us. In our, at that point, we had moved after that duplex. When my dad started making a little more money, we live in a very modest house off of West Jefferson in Springfield. And so Paul lived with us for about a half a year. And I mean, again, very vivid memories of our discussions around the kitchen table and how he would dress compared with my dad you were talking about Paul's short pants and stuff, but my dad was like the worst dresser you can imagine. You know, he'd wear short sleeves year round with suits and, you know, ties, and he'd always have stains on his shirts because he'd be eating. And
I would not criticize anyone for that. That is in the fine tradition of old newspaper men who'd be going to politics.
So. Well, he was bad. But Paul and my dad would wear he had this pink tie-dyed shirt that our neighbor girl gave to him, and he'd wear his underwear just walking around the house. It didn't matter who was there. And Paul would wear pajamas and a robe, and it'd be all tied up and everything. And it was just like, oh my gosh, this is just so unusual. we weren't used to something like this. But but Paul being around our house for about a half a year was, if you think about some of the conversations we were able to have, this is a guy who wrote how many books, David? Many, many, many books.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you probably have some of them behind you. And I have, I think, every single one of his books. I haven't read them all, but I have them all, and they're all inscribed to my dad. But, I would say my growing up years were having people like Paul Simon and, you know, Dick Durbin. His first job out of law school was with
– longtime senator from Illinois.
Yeah, and he worked with Paul Simon. So it would be people who were leaders in Democratic politics would come over to our house because my dad was a very social guy. And not that my mom was a great cook, but she didn't care if people stopped by at any hour. She'd, you know, make him an ice cream sundae or whip something up. And we had unbelievable conversations. And what I so appreciate about my family is there wasn't one time where I was ever shushed or told to go away because it was an adult conversation. I could always sit there, and I just would sit there and listen. And really, my only role would be my dad would say, "Can you get us a Bud out of the fridge?" And I'd go and get the Bud and Budweiser, and while the door was open, I'd take a quick little sip. And
probably not for Paul Simon, though.
No, he was a Pepsi drinker. You remember that?
Yeah, I sure do.
Oh no, he never drank any beer. But my dad was a beer drinker.
I always remember traveling with Paul, and I managed his campaign for the Senate in 84 with David Wilhelm. He and I ran the campaign together. And we'd be on the road, and Paul would say, "Dave, Can you? I think I need a Pepsi Cola. Can you get me one of those? So, but you didn't then choose to go into politics or public service. You took the other route into journalism. Why?
Really, kind of by accident. I realized I loved politics. Absolutely loved it, and did from the. You know, my earliest memories. I loved those conversations. I loved being in the know. I even as a kid, I read the newspaper every day. But so what happened is I went to Illinois College, followed in my mom and dad's footsteps. My mom and dad both went there in Jacksonville. Ended up transferring my junior year and went to University of Maryland, majored in government and politics. Came back. I interned with the Illinois State Senate, thinking that I wanted to do something in politics, and realized in that internship that I didn't like it at all.
Why?
We sat in a room smaller than this, a small room with, there were four interns.
We're in the modest worldwide headquarters of the Axe Files here, is what she's pointing
and
to.
And this is very
at the
plush.
University of Chicago and the Institute of Politics.
Yes, and it's beautiful. And this is probably almost twice the size of this little room that we were in. There were four interns. I loved my fellow interns. I keep in touch with two of them to this day. And my job was to analyze bills and write a synopsis of those. And, you know, I was, 20? I would have been 21, 22 years old. And it was boring to me. And I realized that this is not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be in an office looking at bills all the time and write what they meant. And so
you sound like the president. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh my God!
I digress. I hope
President Obama. But no, but at that age, it was like it did not at all interest me. So literally, somebody says in passing to me, "You ask so many questions. You ought to be a reporter." And I have, you know, I think I was born to be a reporter, and I think I probably still could be a reporter and be a good one because I have a curiosity about virtually everything, and I never run out of questions. So being on the receiving end of questions is not as comfortable for me as asking questions. And so I applied at the Public Affairs Reporting Program, which is a master's level program through University of Illinois at Springfield now, and was accepted into that. And that's how I began my journalism career. I started in a news bureau covering the state legislature, writing for four newspapers in the state. One of those newspapers hired me when I was done with that master's program.
In the Quad Cities.
In the Quad Cities. I started out...
On the western Illinois bordering Iowa.
Yep. So I moved to Moline. I didn't know anything about the Quad Cities. It was 1985. The economy was terrible. John Deere was on strike. The Quad Cities was a very different community than Springfield, what I was used to. And, my goal was I'd be there a year. And then I was going to go to the Chicago Tribune. Mm-hmm. Well, 6 months later, I'm on the cop beat. That was my first beat at the paper. And, I meet this guy, named Jerry Bustos. It was a third shift party. And so all that means is, you know, the cops get off at 8 o'clock in the morning. They work the midnight to 8 shift. And at the time, I worked, 5 p.m. to 1:30 a.m.
Yeah, that was pretty much the shift that I had when I started at the Tribune.
Yeah. What was your first beat?
That was it.
You were
on
the cop beat? Yeah. Great beat, isn't it? Because cops are notoriously tough to get, you know, they don't trust you. And so how do you get them to trust you?
Well,
so
the other thing is that it exposed me to sides of life that I just never had seen before.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, often tragic, mm-hmm. but also you saw great heroism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real education. Now, but there was that problem that the end of the workday was you didn't want to, like, go home and go to sleep at the end of your work day because you don't want to start winding down while you're at work. And so there weren't a whole lot of places to go other than saloons, and I spent a lot of time in them back
then.
So
did I. So did I. But that's how I met my husband-to-be, was at this third shift party at a tavern in downtown East Moline called the Lil Cowbell.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not little. So I'm not pronouncing that like, you
right,
know.
In case
like
any
I don't
of the
know.
Home folks are listening.
Yeah, but this is a place they literally had seatbelts on the bar stools. And so I meet him. And
that sounds very practical, actually.
It's, you know, not terribly upscale. but we met and got married a year after that, and then, you know, started raising our family. And I had pretty much had every beat you can have at the newspaper, and really loved every day of my career. But David, back to your point about what you see when you're a reporter, you are exposed literally to the worst possible scenarios in people's lives. You know, maybe after somebody loses a loved one in a car crash or a murder.
Yeah. My first story ever. When I worked at the Tribune was a tornado in Lamont, which is a suburban community
that
just devastated Lamont. And that was something I had never been exposed to. And, you know, people's lives were, some were lost, but their lives were roiled by this in a way, you know, I couldn't have imagined.
Yeah, so. I mean, it is literally exposure to people in the best of times, their best of times in their lives and the worst of times in their lives. And, you know, meeting everyone again from, you know, accused or convicted murderers to presidential candidates. And being a newspaper in eastern Iowa, I always lived in Illinois, but being a newspaper there, all of the presidential candidates, you know, we'd have access to all those guys. And
And so accused criminals and politicians, which in Illinois can often be
that
the same
thing. It does happen in Illinois, unfortunately.
Yeah, a few of those governors you mentioned.
Otto only Kerner four governors have gone to prison in my lifetime, but
That's,
and it is bipartisan in Illinois too when it comes to governors going to prison.
It is. Hopefully, that's a trend that will not continue.
Yes, I hope.
Yeah, but so you. You did that for 17 years.
Yeah, I did.
And what made you decide to leave journalism?
Well, it was a combination of turning 40, 9/11 happened, and a job offer came to me. And the reason I bring up the, you know, turning 40 and 9/11 is every 10 years of my life, I've always kind of done this reassessment. You know, am I doing what I should be doing? Am I making a difference? Should I be considering doing something else? So I did that when I was 30, 40, 50. And when I turned 50, I ran for Congress. And so that happened. 9/11 happened. And if you remember,
anyway, go ahead.
So if you can think about your, you know, all of our emotions with 9/11, right? It was, everybody was thinking about, gosh, life changes in an instant.
Yeah.
So that was happening, and I literally get a call. I'm in the middle of the newsroom. I get a call from the president of one of the health systems in our region.
Let me have you hold that thought. And we're just going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Congresswoman Sherry Bustos. So you were telling me about the offer that came in.
Yeah,
from
so
this
I get a call from the president of this health system and says, you know, we have a new CEO. We would like to hire you to be our director of communications. And I immediately said, no, thank you. And he said, well, you want to just talk about it? And I said, no, I said, I'm really not looking. And I, you know, I love what I do. And, you know, that back to the 9/11 and the turning 40, I was just going to figure out, you know, what was my path going to be the editor of the paper? Mm-hmm. That was really kind of how I was reassessing things. So I go home that night.
The interim steps, you know, I'll never forget, sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
You know, that was always held out. I left the newspaper when I was young, like 28, 29 years old. And they said, you ought to stay. You could be editor of the newspaper someday. But one of my colleagues said, but in between, you have to do all these other jobs. And he said, you know what an assistant city editor is? And I said, no. And they said, that's a mouse trying to become a rat.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I didn't want to be part of this whole corporate thing. And when I switched, but anyway, so back to enough about me. Let's talk about
I could talk about you all day long. I can start asking you questions, David. Anyway, I go home that night and I tell my husband, hey, I get this call about this. And he goes, what'd you tell him? I said, I told him I wasn't interested. He said, why would you say that? And I said, because I'm not interested. And he said, well, why don't you just hear him out? I said, yeah, you know, I guess, you know, what do I have to lose? So I end up meeting with the guy. At the end of the conversation, he said, are you interested? And I said, well, I'm intrigued. And he said, well, let me set up a meeting with the CEO. I go meet with the CEO. immediately. It's like, you know how sometimes you meet people and you think, I am very impressed with that person. Mm-hmm. I could work with that guy. So I meet the CEO, a guy named Bill Lever. He came from Michigan, Detroit, Michigan, at a health system, came to our region of the Quad Cities. And after meeting with him, I thought, I'd like to work with that guy. Take the job, and that's what I ended up doing. I moved up, ended up becoming, I started out as a director of corporate communications, ended up being a senior director, then a vice president of the larger health system for a number of years. And, you know, so did that for 10 years. And during that, I also was allowed to get very involved in the community, something you can't do as a journalist, right? I mean, you can't serve on boards. Right. You can't run for office. You can't do any of that. You can't even pound a yard sign.
Right.
But while I was doing that job, I was actually encouraged by my boss to get involved. So I served on a lot of boards.
Let me just ask you one thing about this, though. In addition to permitting and encouraging this community involvement, mm-hmm. how much did that experience educate you about the healthcare system?
Oh, it educated me quite a bit about the healthcare system. I mean, part of my job was to make sure that, people could navigate the health system. Part of my job was to make sure that when there were people who couldn't afford their care, how are we going to make sure that they could afford their care? And, you know, raising money through our foundation. I didn't physically raise the money there, but I wanted to make sure that our foundation was successful so we could help people. Again, transitioning from journalism to healthcare, you saw people in their happiest of time, you know, after a baby's born or something like that, to, you know, their absolute worst time in their lives.
Yeah.
And saw so many people struggling. And people who couldn't afford their care, and, you know, how were we as a health system going to help them? We were a nonprofit health system. Mm-hmm. And but learned a lot about the business component
Did that help you when you got to Congress? And, you know, you're obviously still dealing with these healthcare issues in a big way.
Yeah, a great deal. When I worked in this health system, it was during a period that was before the Affordable Care Act, during the Affordable Care Act at passing, and then after. So, you know, we knew that we were on an unsustainable path, how we were delivering health care. It was too expensive. The costs were going up too much every year. And yet the outcomes for patients were not improving. So we did a lot within our health system because we had this innovative CEO that said, let's take control of our own destiny and figure out how we are going to bring costs down and improve patient outcomes. And so we were on the path to do that during all of the Affordable Care Act negotiations.
And how did the Affordable Care Act affect your health system?
Actually, initially, I think in a pretty good way, because the Affordable Care Act, this gets a little bit in the weeds, but you remember the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation?
Yes.
That allowed for demonstration projects, pilot projects all over the country that allowed hospitals and health systems and clinics to try new ways of delivering care. And we took on some of those. Where, for instance, you know, you'd bundled payments if you were going to get a hip replacement, that the patient knew, the insurance company knew there would be one cost. Didn't matter if there were complications. That mm-hmm. included your rehab, your anesthesia, the surgery fees, all of that.
Yeah.
And so
there was an impetus to do it right.
Yeah. Yeah. But so I went into Congress when I eventually ended up running for Congress and winning, having a pretty decent understanding about healthcare. And even on a personal level, I had a when the Republican who I ended up defeating, literally when he was elected, he defeated a sitting Democrat in our congressional district in northwestern Illinois. When he was elected, my brother was on his deathbed.
I remember that your brother was a baseball coach at Southern Illinois, and he had cancer.
Yeah, my brother Dan Callahan had been, he was a high school baseball coach and then went to coach at Eastern Illinois University for 5 years and then was the head coach at Southern Illinois University for 16 years. And he had this rare form of cancer that the doctor would prescribe treatment that the insurance company would not cover. And when you see something like that up close with a family member and how to figure all of that out, how you're going to get the care that a doctor's saying you need to stay alive, yet the treatment is, you know, many thousands of dollars for every dose. And knowing that I and my family were not at all unique, that this was happening all over the country, we knew that we needed to do something with healthcare. And I think, frankly, what the Trump administration is doing right now and through this tax bill that just passed that will knock an additional 13 million Americans off their health insurance is just, I don't know how anybody could support doing something like that, or how anybody could take pride in saying that we're going to, we want this to be a destroyed Obamacare. And I call it the Affordable Care Act. I don't call it Obamacare because I think there are too many people who have negative views of
you.
That.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And
it's interesting.
Helped a lot
well,
of people.
You know the experience in Kentucky was they rebranded the program as Kentucky Connect. And if you ask them even about the Affordable Care Act versus Kentucky Connect, which was quite successful because the governor was supportive in reducing uninsured, the rate of uninsured there,
right.
People liked Kentucky Connect. And when Mitch McConnell ran for re-election there, he said, well, I support Kentucky Connect. I just have concerns about the Affordable Care Act.
You know, and that's the phoniness of politics that I just, it is really hard for me to accept that is part of politics. And I know it is, again, you know, we've talked about, how long you've been in politics, how long I've been around it. I'm only in my third term right now. I learn something new every day. But that kind of talk that the person who's saying it knows it's phony as it's coming out of his mouth is just, you know, I think it's a disturbing element of politics.
You must be disturbed quite a bit in Washington.
I am. And you know, but I have hope. I really do. We're sitting here and, you know, the start of 2018 and I have a lot of hope. There's great candidates running for Congress all over this country. And I'm my political role at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is I'm chair of Heartland Engagement. So I'm working with all of the candidates in the Midwest who are running in these tougher districts and kind of some of the Trump land. And I'm very, very encouraged by a number of the candidates who are running. And I think we've got a really good shot at picking up a number of seats.
I want to talk about that. Before I do, though, we missed sort of a big stage in your life, which is the decision to run for public office in the first place, because you were a city council member in East Moline before you ran for Congress. What made you decide, having not gone the political route and deciding that wasn't for you, becoming a journalist, going into the healthcare field, what brought you back to actually running for public office?
Well, running for city council, East Moline is a town of 21,000 people. I ran in one ward where there are seven seats, so I literally represented only 3,000 people. So, you know, not this huge base of our constituency. Mm-hmm. But the reason I decided to do that is the same reason why a lot of women run is I was asked. It is not something that just popped in my head. I literally, when I was a journalist and then even going into healthcare, I had no plans on the horizon to run for office. It was not something I thought I would ever do. But I was asked. It was an open seat. And actually, what went through my head, I had covered the city for about 5 years. That was one of my beats. And my first thought was, I think I could do better than a lot of the council members I've covered over the years. And so made the decision that I wanted to run and make a difference in, you know, that little part of the city of East Moline. It was a three-way primary. I ended up winning. And
lots of TV, I bet.
Zero TV. But what was interesting, though, is, you know, I have a journalism background and a public relations communications background. So I ran a And I raised a decent amount of money, more money than anybody running for alderman ever had. So I had this, my literature was, it had full color, wasn't black and white. It wasn't like, Xeroxed or anything. It was very professional looking. I actually had billboards because I knew the guy who ran the billboard company. And he said, if I pay for the what's going to be posted, he'd give me time. It'd be an in-kind contribution.
The local government is, I always think it's the most vital level of government because you're closest to people. And like when you represent 3,000 people, they all know you, they know where you live, they see you in the grocery store. They see you at ball games.
I loved it.
And they let you know exactly what's on their
mind.
Yes,
they do. You know, anything from calls about a pothole right in front of their driveway that needed to be filled to I remember a neighbor walking down the street in the middle of the summer waving her water bill and saying that she was going to go to the press if I didn't take care of this. And I mean, from a stop sign or whatever it is, but I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I was raised, and if you talk to anybody who ever knew my father, you know, we were raised to, you return every phone call and you return it the day you get it.
I remember that.
And you know, that his time was before emails and all of that. But, you know, so my philosophy, and if you ask anybody who works in our, whether it be our political or our governmental office, we return every phone call we get, we respond to every email. And so, I was easily reelected, for a second term, but, and I think it was based more than anything on, if I got a call, I took care of it. I had a great relationship with most of the city department heads, so especially the guy who would fill potholes and do that kind of thing. So I could literally call the guy who was in charge of maintenance services, and he'd go out within an hour of me calling him and fill a pothole. And it made me look really good, and I have deep appreciation.
And does that translate as a member of Congress? I mean, are there did you learn habits there that have been useful to you?
Yeah, I mean, we have the same philosophy as you know. I think there's three things and that you need to do to be a good public servant. And I don't think it's a heck of a lot more complicated than that. But number one, you better work hard. You know, in our case, as a member of Congress, I make $174,000 a year. Maybe some people who are listening to this might think, okay, well, that's nothing. But people who I represent, where the average household income is $45,000, I'm making darn good money. So I better work hard for it because it's their dollars. It's their tax dollars that are paying my salary. Number two, if you have a fight on your hands, you better fight. And you better fight hard. And number three, you better get results. And it doesn't matter that I'm in the minority party, that we have a 24-vote deficit in Congress. It doesn't matter. The expectation is that as a member of Congress representing the 700,000 people in the 14 counties that I represent in central and western and northern Illinois, that I get something done. And so that is I approached my job as a city council member the same way. You know, you're not there just to sit in a chair and you know, listen to people, other members of the city council talk. You're there to get something done. And that's how I view my job now and I did as a city council member.
So when you got elected in 2006, your district, I remember when Lane Evans got elected, young progressive, it was really kind of a lightning bolt when he got elected from, because that district had not been represented by a Democrat for 100 years before he won that seat. And it had, after he retired because of illness, he's now sadly passed away. That district changed hands and there was a Republican. You defeated that Republican and you've won re-election twice. And you won last time President Trump was carrying the district. So now everybody, you make pilgrimages to the Quad Cities to say, what is the magic elixir that allowed you to win by, what, 20 points in a district that Trump had won? And what is that formula?
Well, so go back to that, you know, what I believe public servants should do, work hard, fight for people and get results. But, you know, the other thing we do is, and this comes very naturally to me, but, you know, I listen to people. You know, David, you go back to your reporting days and, you know, you didn't do all the talking, right?
Right.
You asked questions and you listened and that's how you had information to be able to put together a great story. And again, my comfort level really is, and as much as I'm talking now, is really asking questions and drilling down and understanding people. I love personal stories. I love being around people. I'm very much an extrovert. That's how I get energy, is being around people. And I am perfectly comfortable in any neighborhood in our congressional district.
So explain why why Trump carried your district.
Well, so 11 of the 14 counties in the 17th Congressional District of Illinois are rural. The towns in most of these counties might be 200, 300, 400, 500 people. I'll give you a couple quick examples. Maytag, all right? Your former boss, President Obama, talked about what happened at Maytag. But for your listeners, it was 13 years ago, last September, that Maytag up and took every last one of the more than 1,000 jobs to Mexico. And here we are 13 plus years later in Knox County, Illinois, and the wages there still have not recovered because those were good union jobs. People could support their families on those jobs, but they just up and left to Mexico.
So you agree with him on the issue of trade. Is that fair to say?
Well, we've got to be smart about trade. You know, I mean, trade also is critical to agriculture. Mm-hmm. And ag is the biggest economic driver in the state of Illinois. I know that's a surprise to some people in Chicago, but it is still our biggest economic driver. And so we've got to be smart about trade. But I'll tell you what I do agree with is we've got to do something about giving companies incentive to stay in our country instead of shipping jobs overseas. And I think we've got some good policies to address that. But the Maytag example was just one. We had another one in Stevenson County, which is in the northern part, during my first campaign. Bain Capital had bought a company called Sensata, decided to take every one of those jobs that were good-paying jobs where people could support their families, send all those over to China. And, you know, you've got people who are training their replacements. You know, the Chinese workers would come over and they would have to train their replacements. I became very close with a lot of the people who lost their jobs, and I still keep in touch with them. I mean, they're heartbreaking. And then, you know, in my first term after I was elected, there was another company in Joe Davis County, which is in a town called Hanover, that sent a company called Robert Shaw. They had almost a 0% defect rate on these little valves that they would make to regulate water in dishwashers, and a nearly 0% defect rate, and yet all of those jobs got sent over to Mexico. So why did President Trump win, and why did Hillary Clinton not do well in a district like mine? Because people who have gone through that, whether it's their own family or their neighbors or their entire community, who are making half what they were before those jobs went away, they're hurting. And they, in some cases, have to work two or three jobs. They can't buy new F-150 trucks or Silverados like they used to every 4 or 5 years. And they're hurting. And how you find out that people are hurting is you go where they are. I don't like to just go to Democratic Party functions. I go to supermarkets on Saturday. We actually call it Supermarket Saturdays, where I have zero agenda other than to walk up and down the aisles and introduce myself and say, what's on your mind? What do you want me to know? I'm going to be heading back out to Washington on Monday. What do you want me to work on? What's concerning to you?
We got to take a short break. Yep. We'll be right back with Sherry Bustos. This issue of listening, do you feel that the Clinton campaign, Hillary Clinton, and the Democratic Party generally did a poor job of that in 2016? Do you think that the messaging of the Democratic Party did not speak to your constituents?
No, I don't think that a lot of people felt like they were listened to. I'm one of only 12 Democrats in all of Congress serving in a district that Donald Trump won in. And yet, if Democrats are going to win back the majority, we've got to figure out how we're going to do well in these districts. And I think part of it is going to where people are. Don't just go to, you know, the Democratic fish fry on a Friday night during Lent, but go to the supermarkets. I do something else we call Sherry on Shift, and all that is I job shadow people. But when I'm doing that, I'm standing shoulder to shoulder with a welder, or somebody's teaching me to drive a forklift, or I'm processing carp that have been caught out of the Mississippi River, or I'm at a car repair shop, or I'm mixing chemicals, or whatever it is. And I'm standing shoulder to shoulder with people, and I'm asking them, you know, especially if their boss is out of range, you know, when was the last time you got a raise? Were you and your family able to take a vacation last year? And, you know, and you learn a lot from people when you ask them, what do you do for fun? And when you, one of my most vivid memories of that conversation was, it was a home care nurse, woman married to a guy who worked for one of the cities in the region where I live. They had two kids. And when I said, what do you guys do for fun? And she said, we have cable television. And I said, do you not like to go to movies? And she goes, no, we watch movies on cable television. That is how we have entertainment, because they can't afford to do other things. And you only know those stories if you get out and listen to people.
Yeah, we have a home in rural Michigan, and we had a fire there, and the volunteer firefighters came. It was actually on New Year's Eve some years ago, an appliance malfunctioned and started a fire, and these guys charged into this building and they struck the fire and saved our home. And I said afterwards, so you guys just volunteer to do this? And I said, no, we get $8 an hour, and that, you know, then we can take our family out to dinner once in a while with that. And it was striking, was striking.
But there are so many stories.
What about culturally? What about the cultural gulf, the sense that there's this sort of metropolitan elite that kind of look down on small towns in rural America, that Trump seemed to tap into this whole point of not just that the system was rigged, which is what you're talking to on the economy, but that you're disrespected?
Well, they don't want people coming in and talking about social issues all the time either. That's a part of the component here. What I was hearing when I do our supermarket Saturdays was jobs and the economy. They wanted us to focus on what are we going to do to improve their lives? What are we going to do so that their kids who grew up in this town of 400 people want to come back and stay when they get out of school, or want to take over the family farm or whatever it is? And they view too many Democrats as focusing on things that aren't important to them. My voting record on, the vast majority of the social issues that Democrats believe in is no different than, the vast majority of Democrats. But it's not what I talk about when I go into a room. I try to have a conversation about what's important to people. I try to do my best to listen. But, you know, we talk about what we've done to help fight for jobs in the economy.
There's been a lot of discussion about, I've said, and I've before, I admire Nancy Pelosi. She was speaker during the 2 years that I worked in the White House. She had as much to do with the success of the Affordable Care Act and some of the other initiatives of President Obama as anyone. And she's a very canny and, really in certain ways brilliant legislative leader, as you know. But some of your colleagues, Seth Moulton and others, have complained that she is a negative image in some of these swing districts where Democrats have to win. What's your cut on that? Because I know you've got one foot in sort of both camps, in that you have concerns about the image of the Democratic Party, and you're also in the leadership in a kind of peripheral way.
Yeah, so my leadership role, we talked about what I'm doing politically and working with candidates in the Heartland region. But on the governmental end of things, I was actually elected among my colleagues to be one of the chairs of the Democratic Policy and Communications Committee, so which means I do have a seat at the leadership table. And here's what I think we need to think about as the future of Democrats in Congress. As I sit around that table, I am the only Midwesterner sitting around that leadership table. I am the only person sitting around that table who comes from a Trump district. Almost everybody sitting around that leadership table comes from a entirely strong Democratic district. And I would contend that every place that we have a Democratic district in the United States— congressional district, we have a Democrat. Where we don't have as many Democrats are in these swing districts that we have to win in order to get back in the majority and do things to fight for people. And as much as we value diversity in our party, and I'm so glad we do, because I think every organization's stronger if you have a diverse group of people sitting around the table, we do not apply the same level of valuing that diversity when it comes to geographic diversity. And I want to help bring about that change.
That's sort of a problem with the system right now, isn't it? Because you've got the majority of Democratic districts are solidly Democrat, never really a general election like the one you faced. The majority of Republican districts are solidly Republican, never a general election. So the only real threat to incumbents is in primaries, and it doesn't lend itself to compromise, to construct a bridge building.
I think the two biggest problems in our democracy right now are how we do redistricting and campaign finance. We need to fix both of those things, and I think we would have a much better country if we did that. If we had more swing districts like mine, where I can tell you, when I'm not out in Washington, I'm back in Illinois. And I'm walking the supermarket aisles, and I'm job shadowing people, and there are people in these very, very Democratic districts who they don't have to work hard. They probably don't even have to have a robust constituent service operation. And I think we would be a much better country if we had more swing districts.
So I can't let the whole thing go without you answering my question, which is Pelosi a problem for candidates in these swing districts? Not just her, but the entire leadership, which has been there. I mean, they're all. She got mad when I asked her this, and said it was a sexist question because I wouldn't ask this of men. But
would you ask it of men?
I would ask it, yes, because I think leaders do become.
Yeah, I don't see it as a sexist question by any means, and I think it's a fair question. She has been really a remarkable leader.
Yeah, I stipulated that.
Yeah, and I think after 2018, let's see how we do, and let's see who ends up.
But you
running.
Don't think she will? She's an impediment to recovering the House.
Well, I think anybody who's in that leadership role, who's ever speaker, who's ever leader, is criticized. They are. I mean, look at Mitch McConnell. You know, he's brought into every Senate race mm-hmm. in the country. Look at Paul.
I think
Ryan.
That's a fair point, and I do think, and I raise this with Congressman Moulton, mm-hmm. which is, wouldn't anybody
yes.
in that role become a target and therefore utilized in these campaigns? But the longevity does make it easier to do that because there's more familiarity.
Yeah, but we've got some really outstanding newer, younger members of Congress who their day will come. And you know, it's a matter of time when people will run for various leadership roles. And I have confidence in our caucus that we will make good decisions as to who we're going to elect to our leadership. And but, you know, I mean,
does it hurt the Democratic Party that so many of its leaders are in Congress and out? Some of the leading candidates and so on are up in years, in their upper 70s. The Democratic Party presents itself as a party that's forward-looking, but...
Yeah, I think if you look at the candidates who are running here in 2018, we have a woman named Melissa Slotkin in Michigan who was had worked with the CIA, and she's one of the most innovative, creative candidates I have seen in a long time. We've got Brendan Kelly, who's running in Southern Illinois, who's a state's attorney, a veteran himself. We have a woman named Abby Finkenauer who's running in eastern Iowa, would be the youngest woman ever elected, mm-hmm. You know, comes from a union household. We've got young people. We have smart people. We have veterans.
But they're not the leaders of the party. They're not the face of the Democratic Party today.
No, but in time, they will be the face of the Democratic mm-hmm. Party. And we've got a very, very important election in 2018 where to win back the House, we have to pick up 24 seats. And that's what I think we need to stay focused on, making sure we're successful, not for the sake of the Democratic Party. But I really do believe to my bottom of my heart that we need to do this for the sake of our country. I believe that we have the policies that help families succeed and can address, you know, some of the struggles that we're seeing in a congressional district like mine and in a state like Illinois.
Although, there, you know, the complaint you hear is that there isn't a – I think it's hard for parties to define themselves absent a president, but you do hear the complaint that people don't really know exactly what it is that the Democratic Party stands for. And it seems to me that there are – that every district is different, mm-hmm. and there has to be some respect for those differences as well. You didn't win because of the National Democratic Party. You won because of the campaign you ran that was tailored to the district that you knew and in which you've lived all your adult life. But I don't know that people have a sense of what the Democratic Party stands for right now. I think that people are – there are a lot of people who are nervous and anxious about where the president is leading. Though I don't know about if that's true in your district, is it? I mean, do you sense any?
I think we have a damaged brand, the Democratic Party, and I think we've got to rebuild trust. I think we need to start focusing on what people want us to focus on. I think we need to stop going down all of these diversionary routes that President Trump leads us down, and we just need to stay focused on people and families and what is going to help them have hope for their own futures, whether they live in rural the rural Midwest or whether they live in one of the coastal bigger cities. And I believe that we have the right policies. We have to keep talking about that. And, you know, the impeachment vote that we had to take a couple weeks ago, I think was a terrible plan to do that. And I expressed that to Al Green, who was the one who forced us to vote on that. I was very disappointed.
Congressman from Texas.
Yeah, I was very disappointed that it got to the point where we had to vote on impeaching the president at a time where we've got an investigation going on that's continuing, rather than just let that play out and see where that leads. The truth comes out in the end. I have a belief in that. And that's just that's self-inflicted damage in congressional districts like mine and the ones that we need to do well in. Because, you know, in my district, Donald Trump is not underwater. He is not, you know, there are people.
So he's not a damaged brand in your district?
Not as damaged as he is in some of the other districts. I mean, we've done some polling here within the last, 4 or 6 weeks that shows he is not underwater. Mm-hmm. And
meaning that he's more popular than unpopular.
It's about even. Mm-hmm. It's about even. But people are still willing to give him a shot. Mm-hmm. And so I see my job as, again, working hard, fighting and getting something done. The only way I can get something done is to work across the aisle and to have ideas that I can get my friends on the Republican side to be agreeable with me on. Because I can't do it with a 24-vote deficit. No Democrat can.
This is a random question that I should have asked you earlier when you mentioned that your husband spent a career in law enforcement. How do you feel about those issues, which have been very, very divisive, these issues about police community relations that have boiled over in so many places, including Chicago? And what perspective do you bring, given your personal relationships?
Yeah, I believe when you look at police officers, they're no different than any other profession in that there are good police officers and there are bad ones. There are people who are, are Democrats, and there are people who are Republicans in law enforcement. There are, criminals who are in law enforcement, and there are exemplary people. And, you know, it's just like in politics or in business or anything else. We've got to make sure that we are addressing the problems and some of the perceived problems, especially in the minority communities. But what I don't do, nor would I do, and it actually leaves a very bad feeling with me, is when people generalize that all cops are bad, or that that there can't be a positive relationship between the minority community and the law enforcement community. My husband and I have both been members of the NAACP way before I was in Congress or on the city council, and way before he was sheriff of Rock Island County, Illinois, because we believe in making sure that, we have good relationships with, all parts of our community. I just don't like these broad brushes that are painted on people or professions. And it's just like as a politician, what is Congress has a are we at single digit approval rating?
Yeah, you're
rating?
Not doing well. You're slightly above the temperature in Chicago, but the temperature in Chicago is about zero.
Well, you know, and so where people feel like because you're an elected official or because you're a member of Congress that you're a bad person or you're corrupt or whatever it is. What I said at a luncheon in Galesburg, Illinois yesterday is a guy came in, a Republican came in to our luncheon and said that he supported me and he voted for me. And I was one of the few Democrats he would support or had supported. And but I was helpful to him on an issue. And so I thanked him. I said, you know, I really appreciate you coming into this group and saying something like that and sharing a compliment. Because while I don't think I'm any better than anybody just because of the job that I have, I also don't think I'm any worse than anybody. And then when people feel like they can beat up on whether it's, you know, politicians or whether it's police officers or anything, I just think, you know, let's just take a look at the person. Let's take a look at, you know, what we can do to make things better. And that's really kind of
not
my approach to it.
That we're the political environment that's been created right now. It's a difficult environment. One other issue that surfaced is in a big way lately is sexual harassment and worse. Some members of your caucus and of the Congress have had to leave as a result of it. We've seen it across many different realms. What's your view of all of that? And it seems like a positive moment in the sense that behaviors that weren't permissive, proscribed before are now, and that, you know, there's a greater awareness of this. On the other hand, there's it seems like there's a kind of frenzy about it. You saw a colleague of yours across the rotunda, Al Franken, left rather than waiting to have a hearing because there was such a rush to force him out. Where's this all going?
We need to have a system in place to be able to process this in a way that makes sense. I mean, we can't just keep doing these one-offs and all of that. But
was he treated fairly, you think?
You know, it was his decision to resign. And I know there were, you know, many of his colleagues.
That's like saying there were 30 colleagues behind him on the and he was standing on the precipice and they were pushing. So you could say it was his decision, but he had a lot of encouragement to leap.
So I want to make sure that I'm getting this right, but I believe there were 13 women who had come forward by the time.
I don't know what the numbers were, but I mean, you know, he yeah. There, I'm not defending his behavior, yeah. And he was headed to the ethics committee, probably yeah. Belonged there.
But I do think it was his decision. I mean, he could have stayed, but I think we need to make sure that we have a system in place. So if there are accusers, there's a process to go through. There are proper hearings or, you know, what the so-called due process that everybody's talking about. But frankly, back to the approval rating of Congress, I think we should be better than think that any kind of sexual harassment is okay. Mm-hmm. I've worked in the private sector my entire life until this job in Congress. And there's not one job that I had either, you know, as a kid or, you know, up until now being in Congress where I haven't seen this. And I think I choose to look at this in a positive way. Let's hope that this is, a wake-up call, that this isn't okay in the workplace.
Yeah, well, that certainly should be that.
Yeah.
So let me just finish up by asking you about your future. You considered a race for governor of Illinois this year. You didn't do it. Why not?
Well, the path to success for me was very, very narrow. And while, you know, I'm not afraid of taking a chance.
It has to be a reasonable one.
Yeah, it has to be reasonable. And it got down to money. I knew exactly what I would have to raise to be able to be successful in a Democratic primary. And
a lot of zeros there.
A lot of zeros, and it would have been making calls nonstop. And, you know, when you've got 102 counties and a very, very large state, you've got to be able to get out and talk with people and let people know who you are. And I would have been raising money nonstop. And when you've got, people in the race who had access
many
to
zeros.
Many zeros as part of their personal wealth, which I do not have, then it would have been a very difficult path.
So do you see a race for higher office in your future?
You know, I'd be open to it, but I think in politics it is so much about timing. You know, what do people want? You know, I'm what I would consider a very, you know, a reasonable Democrat. I don't have a voting record that is far, far, far left. And, you know, we have parts of our state that are farther left than I am. And, you know, so I what I'm proud of is that I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. I know that we have been in a position to help a lot of people. In the short time that I've been in Congress, I'm very proud of the staff that we've put together who understands to their core the importance of working hard and fighting for people and getting results. And that's what I'll continue to focus on. And, you know, we always had a saying in our family that if you do a good job, the future will take care of things. And if you do a bad job, the future will take care of things, too. And, you know, so I'll work hard and fight and be honest and you know, do the best I can, and then we'll see what happens.
Sherry Bustos, so good to see you.
Thank
Come
you.
Back.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.